Sign up to The Economist for in-depth curated expert analysis of world events and topics ranging from business and culture to science and technology. You'll get the weekly digital edition, online-only articles, curated newsletters on politics, the markets, science, culture and China, and full access to The Economist Podcast Plus. The Economist is independent journalism for independent thinking. Go to economist.com and get your first month free.
Your brain needs support, and new Ollie Brainy Chews are a delightful way to take care of your cognitive health. Made with scientifically backed ingredients like Thai ginger, L-theanine, and caffeine, Brainy Chews support healthy brain function and help you find your focus, stay chill, or get energized. Be kind to your mind and get these nootropic chews at Ollie.com. That's Olly.com. These statements have not been evaluated by the Food and Drug Administration. This product is not intended to diagnose, treat, cure, or prevent any disease.
This episode is brought to you by Shopify. Whether you're selling a little or a lot, Shopify helps you do your thing, however you cha-ching. From the launch your online shop stage, all the way to the we just hit a million orders stage. No matter what stage you're in, Shopify's there to help you grow. Sign up for a $1 per month trial period at shopify.com/special offer, all lowercase. That's shopify.com/special offer.
Welcome to the New Books Network.
Hello, and welcome back to New Books in German Studies, a podcast channel in the New Books Network. I'm your host, Leah Greenberg. Today, I'm delighted to be talking with Dora Osborne about her latest book, What Remains, the Post-Holocaust Archive in German Memory Culture, published by Camden House in 2020. Welcome, Dora.
Thanks, Leah. Nice to be here.
So Dora Osborne is a senior lecturer in German at the University of St. Andrews in the UK. Dr. Osborne did her PhD at the University of Cambridge on W.G. Sebald and Christoph Ransmeyer. She then held a postdoctoral scholarship from the Berlin House of Representatives at the Free University of Berlin. She's taught at the universities of Oxford, Nottingham, and Durham. And between 2012 and 2015, Dr. Osborne was a Leverhulme Early Career Fellow at the University of Edinburgh. She recently co-edited the volume Politics and Culture in Germany and Austria Today of the Edinburgh German Yearbook. Dr. Osborne's current research considers how post-human and post-anthropocenic thought finds resonance in contemporary literature and film from Germany and Austria. And I just wanted to take a moment to ask you a bit about what brought you into the field of German studies more generally, memory studies in particular, since the book that we're talking about today, What Remains, looks at memory culture in the Berlin Republic in a period in which most of the living witnesses of World War II and National Socialism are no longer with us. And you posit an archival turn. So we'll talk about that a bit more later, but I'd like to hear just about what brought you to this field.
Yeah, sure. So I think the sort of my interest really grew through my encounter with the work of W.G. Sebald, who's an author who's found resonance really quite widely, sort of much further than just in Germany. As many people know, Sebald's work is really preoccupied with memory. And that preoccupation is definitely connected to German memory and to the memory of the Holocaust, but also is a much kind of wider preoccupation than that. So finds these kind of resonances that might be described as multi-directional, to use the terminology developed by Michael Rothberg. So that's kind of where my interest in the sort of the question of memory grew. I think also I was very interested in psychoanalysis at university, or sort of the way psychoanalysis has understood memory and trauma. And I think probably when I was an undergraduate a long time ago, trauma studies was this kind of strong field that had a lot of resonances with German studies. So I wrote a PhD on W.G. Sebald and on work by an Austrian author, Christoph Ransmeyer, and that had a lot to do with trauma and memory. And one thing that I was struck by in Zabart's work in particular was the sort of the question of material memory. So the way that Zabart's texts are always sort of interested in, on the one hand, sort of objects, artifacts, but also on the other, sort of libraries, museums, archives, and how these material remnants are often sort of threatened by dispersal or by sort of dissolution, and that there was almost a sort of sense in which some of these memory materials were sort of anti-materials that seemed to be affected by the passage of time, by destruction, things that are sort of concern for Zabart. So I think that's where this current book emerged from, was this this question of material memory that I found really powerful in Zabart. And so the book isn't about Zabart explicitly or sort of specifically. I sort of mentioned him a few times, but it was sort of taking a kind of a preoccupation that seemed really important for Zabart and sort of trying to see how it came to play out in other works of literature, but also in films and in sort of memorial culture and memory culture more broadly. So yeah, that was kind of where the project came from.
Okay, so I can definitely see then that how those different interests during your PhD then led to this project, and because it's such a materially centered research project, I was wondering sort of how you then came about to the different case studies that you look at. If you could perhaps give a bit of an overview of sort of your thesis about this archival turn, and then some of the artifacts that you then look at.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. So yeah, as you said, Leah, I guess one of the sort of one kind of premise for the book is sort of trying to understand what I think is the particular significance of the archive in what's been called the post-witness era. So obviously archival materials, archival documents are always important for understanding the past, but at this particular juncture where those with a living memory, with lived experience of the Second World War and the Holocaust reach the end of their lives, it seems that the archive is sort of going to have to take a more prominent role in the work of remembering that past and commemorating that past. So that was sort of, that's sort of one of the kind of foundational sort of ideas, if you like. And then sort of seeing how in different kinds of modes of cultural production, so in literature, but also visual arts, film, memorial projects, that the archive seems to take a more prominent role or seems to be seems to be of importance for artists, for directors, for writers, and trying to understand what the archive means for these projects. And I think importantly, one thing that I wasn't trying to do was to use archives as a historical resource. So you know, I don't go to archives myself. It's not about my own sort of interaction with that kind of material memory. It's precisely sort of seeing how these artists, directors, writers work with either archives or the idea of archives in their memory work, in the sort of work that they do to try and remember the past. So the book is divided into, there's a sort of theoretical chapter, but then there are three chapters where I look at sort of different examples, and the first set of examples are memorial projects. The second set of examples are documentary films and a couple of examples of documentary theatre. And then the last chapter is different kinds of prose narratives. And I just sort of in all of these examples, I'm sort of struck by how the archive is a sort of an important kind of trope in the sort of these different projects in the way that they're engaging with memory. So it's that particular relationship between the archive and memory that I'm interested in.
So you make note of the perhaps non-traditional way in which you're approaching archives in this project as a literary scholar. Mm-hmm. So perhaps for the historian who approaches this book, they might be surprised. And perhaps for a general audience, I thought it would be interesting if you could tell potential readers and our listeners about how you define the archive, and then how the archive is then incorporated into these different memorialization, documentary, theatrical, literary works.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, sure. So I'm sort of taking a very kind of broad definition of the archive, and you know, that could include official documents and resources housed in designated archives with sort of designated people looking after that material, but it could also sort of on the other end of the spectrum refer to much more kind of personal artifacts that kind of come to constitute an archive in an unintended way. And the reason I'm sort of working with that broad definition is because I think in German memory culture and in the sort of discourses that have emerged in sort of understanding how Germany has worked through its National Socialist past and come to engage with the memory of the Holocaust, is that sort of these very different resources are kind of crucial to that project in different ways. You know, just at the very basic level of sort of understanding what happened, official resources are of course incredibly important, but that's actually there's been a sort of sense in which perhaps more personal artifacts almost offer a kind of counter resource. So particularly the work of Marianne Hirsch, for example, her idea of post-memory, she's sort of written about how kind of perhaps more personal artifacts, sort of non-official resources, have a particularly important role to play in sort of coming to understand a traumatic past. It was very important for the project to have a sort of broad understanding of the archive. And then what I'm sort of trying to kind of look at in particular is what I've called the post-Holocaust archive. So a concept of the archive that's very much responding or very much a sort of legacy of trauma, where that kind of material legacy is absolutely marked by the violent history it bears witness to. So in other words, it's incomplete, it's marked by belatedness, it's marked by sort of gaps and lacunae. So in the context of thinking about Germany's violent past, it was really important to sort of to engage in that first chapter with the sort of question of how what remains in this post-witness era is a very kind of complicated resource. So on the one hand, it might be sort of official documents that are sort of precisely the products of a bureaucratic regime. And on the other hand, it might be the sort of the material remnants of violence that are kind of incomplete, that are themselves kind of damaged, and that all of these things somehow constitute what remains for the next generation in this post-witness era, and that sort of understanding the complexity of that legacy is the sort of first step in continuing the work of remembering that past in an era where we're sort of much more dependent on that material legacy.
And you You mentioned these sets of archival materials that we have, both from the bureaucracy that came out of National Socialism, and this these set of artifacts that are full of gaps. And in your first chapter, you articulate some of the theoretical approaches to the archive. And I was wondering if you could expand some on what archives have to do with power, both in a broader theoretical sense and in the case studies that you look at.
Yeah, absolutely. So yeah, that was a really interesting part of the project. And in that first chapter, I'm sort of drawing on different kind of theoretical positions in relation to the archive. And what was sort of interesting in that theoretical reading is that, you know, some of these questions of what an archive is, what it does, what it represents, are very kind of broadly applicable. And so the question of the relationship of between archive and power is you know, something that we can see at work in lots and lots of different contexts, but also to see how some of the theoretical writing relating to archives, I think, is much more focused on the idea of a sort of post-traumatic archive and specifically a post-Holocaust archive. But to come to your question about archives and power, I mean, I think there are sort of different people who are interested in that question. I worked quite a bit with the writing by Elida Asman. So Elida Asman is a really kind of big figure in memory studies and has written a lot about German memory culture. She's written a particularly interesting book about what she calls the new discontent in German memory culture. And Elida Asman writes about the way that archives, when they sort of have a kind of political power, are kind of resources for different kinds of governance and different kinds of authority, but that political power kind of wanes over time as a kind of regime comes to an end, and that's where an archive then might kind of become a sort of historical archive that's used by historians. She also writes really interestingly about the difference between archive and canon, and for Asman, that's sort of cultural memory is sort of made up of an archive, which is sort of all the potential things that we keep about the past. But the canon is what actually gets circulated. So that's a sort of particular way in which the archive has a kind of relationship to power in the context of cultural memory, because there's always a question about what is kept, what is preserved, what is sort of deemed worthy of keeping in the archive, but then what from that archive comes to be used, comes to be put into circulation, whether that's in sort of exhibitions, whether that's in sort of different kinds of ritual. But in any case, the archive, in sort of Asman's description of the relationship between canon and archive, the archive for Asman is a sort of a kind of passive resource, and then the canon is this sort of way in which it's activated. And also, you know, there's kind of more kind of established work by Foucault, sort of the idea of the Foucauldian archive, which is very much about the sort of the question of what can be said, what is available to be said, and that the archive of Foucault is a kind of is about kind of the statements that can be made, so in that sense, the archive is a sort of a question of who gets to say what about whom, In work by Foucault, but also by Alet Farge, this question of sort of archives of, say, prisoners, that these are not necessarily kind of records of individuals that the individuals would have wanted to have kept themselves. So who keeps this record, who makes this record, what kind of narrative is told about a person, and how much control do they have about the sort of record that's left. So I think there's the archive is related to power in all kinds of ways in terms of who has access to what remains of the past, who gets to use what remains of the past, and to what ends do they use those remains of the past. So it's very much a kind of site of power and control. And in work by Jacques Derrida, whose famous book Archive Fever was like a really important point of reference for the project. Derrida emphasizes how etymologically the idea of the archive is linked to a sort of the house of the ruling magistrates who kept certain documents, but also were empowered with the authority to interpret them. So yeah, I think this question of who determines what remains and who determines how those remains are used are these really kind of key questions about power that relate to the archive.
And on the subject of how archival materials are interpreted and utilized, your second chapter focuses on projects of memorialization. And I thought it would be interesting, perhaps as one example, to talk about the well-known Stolperstein. I'm sure many people have seen these stumbling stones, these brass-plated cobblestones that are embedded in many European streets in bearing the names of deported and murdered individuals during the war. And we learn in the book that this project came under quite a bit of scrutiny along with its widespread acceptance and implementation and celebration. And I was wondering if you could expand on this particular example, what some of the problems are raised by this project.
Yeah, I mean, I think it's a really fascinating project, and as you say, you know, it's known by lots of people, and lots of people have sort of commissioned stones. That over 75,000 of these memorials have been laid by the artist Gunter Demnig. So, you know, a really sort of incredible undertaking that I think has been very important for lots of different people. And I think I was interested, I'm sort of just very broadly interested in the project and its evolution. I think that's a really interesting sort of story in terms of how Gunter Demnig developed this project in the context of an art exhibition in Berlin in the 1990s that was initiated really as a response to the ongoing debates about the Holocaust Memorial in Berlin. And this was a group of artists who were really sort of challenging the very idea that you could make a memorial to the Holocaust, to the sort of engaging with questions of representability, the sort of the extent to which there could be a centralized memorial to the victims of the Holocaust, and sort of and questioning that possibility in sort of aesthetic terms. And so Demnig laid, I think it was 51 of these stones in Kreuzberg in Berlin. And I think if you look at the Stolpersteine as they were developed in that context, it seems that was Demnig saying you can't make a centralized memorial for the Holocaust, for the victims of the Holocaust. It needs to be something decentralized, it needs to be something individualized. But that premise of making it a dedication to each individual and making it something that's enacted for each individual makes it sort of impossible because of the scale of the event that's being commemorated. And so that to me seems really, really interesting, that the project was almost a sort of a reply to that sort of debate around the very possibility of a Holocaust memorial. And then Demi takes the project up again a few years later when he's approached by someone who really liked the memorial. And that's when it sort of took off in this kind of, in this much more sort of well-known guise. And as I say, I think, you know, the project means an awful lot to an awful lot of different people. It has, however, sort of received some, or it's been sort of criticised by some people in different ways. It's the notorious ban of the stones in Munich. But also some sort of questions about how, because it's precisely a memorial for individuals, sort of how individuals are sort of chosen, or how it comes to be that certain individuals are memorialized through a stone. And, you know, one sort of criticism of that would be that it's that the memorials are set, the stones are set outside the last place of residence of individuals. And that sort of assumes a kind of, it assumes someone with a residence or a sort of permanent residence. And so the question of, sort of perhaps victims with no fixed abode, for example, and there was a sort of kind of counter project that where stones were set in Alexanderplatz in Berlin, precisely for victims with no fixed abode. And I think what I'm interested in the book is the way that the project has a kind of archival logic, that the project requires research for a stone to be produced and to be laid for an individual. And it kind of carries the evidence of that research in the form of the basic data that are inscribed on the stone. And whether that sort of whether that sort of format has a kind of has sort of bureaucratic echoes that perhaps undo some of that individualizing work. And it's sort of interesting to think about how, in the context of the Berlin Holocaust Memorial, some of the proposed designs did suggest naming and listing individuals where possible, and that gesture was not always seen as something that would be appropriate for that central memorial. So I was just very, very interested in how the sort of the kind of the archival logic of the Stolperstein project on the one hand absolutely is part of the way it's become a really sort of community initiative. It gets lots of people involved, it encourages lots of people to uncover these historical traces, but that it also it makes the project sort of reliant on some of the power structures implied by the sort of the archival material available. And so that was something that I was interested in writing about that project. But I think it's a difficult project to write about because it's something that as I say, it means a lot to a lot of different people, and so how to look critically at the project, but also to understand its significance as well.
Absolutely. And I was interested then in also hearing a bit more about what some of the other projects were in Berlin that you looked at, in particular, some of the memorialization projects of the Bavarian Quarter.
Right, yeah. So this is people might also know this because it's also a very famous project now, kind of a bit older than the sort of most recent iteration of Stolpersteiner. I think it was from 1993, Renate Stee and Frieda Schnocks ordered as their Innans. And people might know this because it's very much sort of embedded in the kind of urban fabric of that particular area in Schöneberg in Berlin. And Stee and Schnock took various parts of legislation that were sort of anti-Semitic legislation that were brought in under National Socialism, and that discriminated against Jewish residents in various ways. For example, about sort of being able to sit on a park bench and or use a public swimming pool. And it on the one side of, so these signs are hung on lampposts, perhaps in the manner of a bus stop or something like that. And on one side of the sign is that legislation, including the date. And on the other, a very kind of bright, simple logo. So if it's about not being able to use a public swimming pool, it'd be a pair of swimming trunks. So very kind of contemporary design. And this was a project that was I think, received a lot of attention, not least because at the time, residents didn't quite understand what was going on. And I think there's a sort of urban myth that one resident called the police because they thought this anti-Semitic legislation was being enacted there and then. But what's really interesting for me about that project is the way that it sort of brings the sort of the archive into a sort of contemporary context and confronts us with that sort of archive of anti-Semitic legislation. And Stian Schnock, of course, very interesting artist who also submitted a design for the competition for the Berlin Holocaust Memorial, where their proposal was to have a regular bus service departing from Berlin, taking passengers to different sites of atrocity, so different concentration camps, on this sort of bright red bus with things like Ravensbrück written on the front. So yeah, very interesting artists working with these sort of memorial questions. And then another project that I looked at, which wasn't in Berlin, was work by Horst Hoheisel and Andreas Knitz. And this was called Zermal in der Geschichte, and was precisely about, it sort of works within the sort of the archival space in Weimar. And Horst Hoheisel has sort of done lots of kind of what are known as sort of counter-memorial projects or sort of counter-monuments, where he's sort of working very much against sort of the idea of producing something and instead commemorating destruction by sort of quite iconoclastic acts of destruction. So his design, notoriously for the Berlin Holocaust Memorial, was to blow up the Brandenburg Gate and to lay the demolished remains in front of the Brandenburg Gate. So not a project that was ever going to be realized, but it was absolutely about kind of challenging the sort of the idea that sort of challenging sort of conventional modes of remembering and commemorating and the sort of structures involved in that.
And in your discussions of these different memorial projects, it's also very evident that there's an element of community input, that there's even if it's a single artist or a group of artists working on the memorial project itself, there is inevitably the input, the collaboration of the community surrounding it. And I was wondering if you could talk a bit more about that, about the collective features of dealing with the past. Ultimately, what your book is talking about is the broader project of Vergangenheitsbewältigung, mm-hmm. the German process of dealing with the National Socialist past.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I think this is a really sort of important question, especially in thinking about how a culture of memory might continue in the post-witness era, in within a generation that has an increasingly sort of distant connection to the history at stake, and in a kind of multimedia age. So I think this, and so, you know, Alida Aslan, when she's writing about what she calls the discontent of contemporary memory culture, for her, there's sort of the important thing is kind of keeping discussions going, keeping memory culture evolving, and key to that would be sort of getting people involved, right? That it's not just a sort of a closed operation. It's something that needs to involve different people. And I think that connects to this sort of the role of the archive, because that's sort of one of the kind of theoretical premises that's sort of talked about by people like Derrida, is that the archive is about the past, but actually it's about the future, right? The archive is only meaningful if it's going to be used in the future. And that, of course, asks the question of who is going to use it in the future. And if any kind of German memory culture that sort of remains committed to remembering the Holocaust is going to develop and evolve, then the archive plays a key role in that. But the archive, as used by different constituents, as used sort of broadly by different generations, I think is really important. And that's something in the context of memorials that's been talked about by Bill Niven. Bill Niven sort of proposes that he sort of describes a kind of development of memorial culture in Germany, so from the counter memorials and counter monuments of the 1980s and the 1990s, as a reaction against sort of the very idea of a monument or memorial in the context of the Second World War and the Holocaust, through to what he calls now combi memorials. And the combi memorial is precisely a memorial project that gets different people involved, that is sort of combines elements of exhibitions and museums, and that is where an artist might be involved, but it's an artist working with the public, getting a community involved in that work. So I think that question of community involvement is really important, and I think it's also been a kind of tension within German memory culture, which I think there's often a kind of tension between the private and the public, between sort of collective memory and sort of particularly family memory, and that's something that kind of comes up particularly in the chapter on documentary films. So talk about two films, one called Zwei oder drei Dinge, die ich von ihm weiß, Two or Three Things I Know About Him, by Malte Ludin, and then Winterkinder, Winter Children, by Jens Schanzer. And these are sort of in a way quite kind of typical stories connected with Germany's Nazi past, connected with German memory culture, where you have, in the case of Ludin, a son, in the case of Schanzer, a grandson, trying to understand their male relatives' involvement in National Socialism. And I look at those films because these directors approach this family question, this personal question, through the archive. And the archive sort of, I think, firstly, that they approach official sources, so it kind of forces them to break the sort of the domestic boundaries of these kind of family stories and move into a sort of more kind of public realm. But it also, I think, by making these films, by making documentary films that then are sort of shown in cinemas across Germany, they're sort of, there's a sense in which these personal histories are somehow finding resonance with much sort of bigger communities, particularly in generational terms. So yeah, I think this is a. It's not something I sort of talk about explicitly in the book, but I think it's a really sort of important kind of important question that sort of underlies a lot of the sort of discourse around memory culture in Germany.
Mm-hmm. And you transitioned beautifully into talking about both the private and public aspects of these processes of family discovery with these documentaries you cover. And And you also conclude that they also act as sites, not just of illuminating information, but also of illuminating the lack of information or of repressed information, of silencing, you say. And this is something that you also talk about in particular in the fourth chapter on literary works of prose with Katya Petrovskaya's book, where she also, you call it, it encounters the specter of what does not remain, of what is lost or what is missing. So I was wondering if you could tell us more about how these troves of information, or sometimes gaps in information, also succeed in obscuring or altering the past.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I mean, I think that's right. But what I think is perhaps a feature of some of the works I look at is that I think the works are, or the makers of these works are very sensitive to that potential for archives to both reveal but also obscure. And I think that's perhaps sort of part of this archival turn that I'm interested in. So, you know, the archival turn, this is about the fact that in a contemporary context, we have to use the archive because after the witnesses, this is what remains to us. But I think the archival turn also heightens our awareness of what the archive is, what it isn't, what it could be, and that's, I think, what I find with these. The works that I look at and the makers of these works is that I think they're extremely attentive to precisely the sort of the fallibility of the archive, if you like, and the particular fallibility of the archive in this post-Holocaust context. So Katya Petrovskaya, it's a really fantastic book, Vielleicht Esther. It's an autobiographical narrator who is so acutely aware that her, you know, she's in, again, a sort of almost kind of quite conventional history in the sense of narrative, in the sense of trying to find out about her family's past. And she's aware herself of this conventionality that she sort of says, I didn't really want to write this story. She wanted to write a family history that was much older, but she kept kind of stumbling over the 20th century. This was a sort of a stumbling block for her. And she's acutely aware that this search for her family history is flawed. It's flawed because of what's available to her. It's flawed by her own prejudices and biases. And it's flawed because the history she's trying to recover is a traumatic history, a history of violence that resists a kind of a complete understanding. And so these, I think this narrative, but also other narratives, they're writing not just about how they turn to the archive to try and understand something, but that in doing so, they're confronted with the flawed nature of this resource, which is ordinarily pitted against something unreliable like memory, right? You know, that the archive is fact, memory is unreliable, right? That sort of a kind of cliched kind of opposition. So I think that's really the thing that I find sort of distinctive about the works that I'm looking at is they're sort of a, you know, it's not just that they use the archive and then this sort of supplements their kind of limited knowledge that's limited through generational distance, say, but it's a sort of an awareness of what it means to have to use these resources and to have to be confronted with their limitations. And Petrovskaya is so wonderful because she has a really wonderful bit where she's trying to find the name of her relatives within, I think it's a telephone book. So there's a list of names that all sound very similar. And she says she's aware that in this search, she wants a particular thing. And in wanting a particular thing, she doesn't want all the other things. And this sort of gets her thinking about how, in sort of undertaking this personal research, there's a sort of an appropriation, if you like, of certain kind of archival resources, in this case of names, but these names sort of signify individuals. And she starts to feel very bad about the other names that she's sort of abandoning when she takes what she wants and then says, well, I don't need you, I don't need these other names, they're not my names. And so she's, Petrovskaya's sort of answer to this is a sort of, she talks about adoption, that actually the generation of this post-witness era, this generation that has to turn to the archive, is under a certain obligation to not simply take what it wants in sort of constructing very personal narratives or very sort of partial narratives. It's under an obligation to take some kind of, I guess, historical responsibility for different actors in the past. And that, I think, is, again, a really sort of distinctive aspect of what some of these authors and directors are doing, is sort of grappling with what their sort of responsibility, what their sort of archival responsibility is, if you like. I found that sort of very striking in the text I was working with, particularly Petrovskaya, who's a fantastic writer.
Yeah, and you point out some important tensions there in sort of how both to deal individually with the archive and with evidence of the past, and also collective responsibility and dealing with the past. You also talk about the tension between, in National Socialism, the project of elimination, mm-hmm. but also the constant documentation. Mm-hmm. And one final tension that you point out in the conclusion that struck me was this need for memory to be both available for completion, you say, mm-hmm. and available for infinite performance, mm-hmm. in a response to what the contemporary nation is. So I was wondering if in closing and talking about the book, you could elaborate on this a bit more.
Yeah. So I think this was, I think the what you've just picked up on was sort of more a kind of problematic, really, of you know, again, to go back to Asman's idea, sort of this kind of unease or discontent in memory culture, sort of, you know, where do we go from here, right? Does it necessarily have to keep performing this work of memory in order to show its commitment, but then does it become a sort of empty ritual? And this is the sort of the kind of inbuilt, if you like, into the language of Vergangenheitsbewältigung, is it a project that sort of is ultimately aiming for some kind of completion, right? And if I'm sort of in the book, I use that sort of vocabulary of work, right? Memory work, mourning work, but also archive work. And if you sort of drawing on that vocabulary of work, it sort of it questions this idea of the task being performed, right? Is it a task to be completed? But then what would that mean? You know, and that's been a big sort of debate in sort of post-war Germany, right? This sort of whole question of can the past ever, should you ever want to draw a line under the past, right? Obviously, lots of people have got into all kinds of trouble for suggesting it could be. But then realistically, what does it mean to keep enacting this work sort of indefinitely? And that was sort of in the sort of introduction, I sort of suggest that archive work is the kind of unfinished business of German memory culture, that archive work is sort of found at the sort of beginnings of memory work and mourning work, particularly thinking about the sort of documentation produced during something like the Frankfurt Auschwitz trials, which is this sort of is seen as this kind of watershed moment in Germany's kind of reckoning with its National Socialist past. But that sort of documentary foundation sort of returns again in this kind of late phase of German memory culture as what I'm calling unfinished business. So yeah, that's a kind of provocation, really, a sort of, you know, if archive work is the sort of task that faces a kind of contemporary generation that is now part of it lives in this post-witness era where a turn to the archive is necessary. Is the archive part of a sort of infinite perpetuation of memory work? Or does it, you know, because there's a sort of finite resource there, does it suggest there's some kind of task to be completed? So that was really one of the sort of bigger questions of the book, was what role does the archive as a kind of trope of memory have for the future of memory work in Germany? And as I say, I think the kind of case studies that I look at, I think these are artists and authors who are very aware of precisely the difficulty of providing any kind of answer to that question, and in highlighting how the archive is anything but a resource that provides definitive answers. It's sort of keeping that question open, I think, in probably quite important ways. In the conclusion, I sort of talk a little bit about the transcripts from the Frankfurt Auschwitz trials are now part of a sort of UNESCO have sort of UNESCO status, and they will now be kind of preserved. And this, I think, is really important because it shows that sort of archive work is this kind of unfinished business, because preserving the records of those trials is really important. But it asks questions about what will happen with the archive, who will use it, perhaps questions about digitization, right? That as this material becomes available digitally, that makes it almost part of a kind of, it makes it sort of much more available, sort of maybe available transnationally. There's technological questions about a sort of archive in a sort of digital mode, but also questions about a kind of global archive in its sort of transnational reach. So I think those are sort of the big kind of next questions in terms of this sort of particular post-Holocaust archive, is sort of questions about mediality. But really, I think the book is what the book is trying to show is that there is an archival turn, there is a turn towards the archive, an acknowledgement that this is that memory has to be archival in the post-witness era, but an awareness of the difficulties that presents in sort of using this post very particular archive, namely the post-Holocaust archive, mindfully. So I don't think the book is sort of trying to answer a question in that sense. I think it's trying to show the sort of it's trying to actually ask some of the questions of what that archival turn means. And I think those are similarly some of the questions posed by these directors and artists and authors.
And it sounds like some of these initiatives, like with UNESCO and the new opportunities presented by technology, mm-hmm. might then be opening up even further into the next era of memory culture.
Right. Yeah. Mm.
Well, I think now I'd be interested in hearing how perhaps your last research project, this one, informs what you're working on next. I'd be curious to hear what's next for you, what you're working on.
Mm-hmm. I think I'm sort of perhaps thinking about those questions of digitization, questions of memory. I'm interested in some of this, the kind of discourse and theory around post-humanism and sort of de-anthropocentric discourse, where the question of memory seems to be such a human one in some ways, right? I think especially in the context of Holocaust memory, that there's a real question about sort of humanity caught up there. Sort of, you know, the necessity of humans remembering something extremely dehumanizing. I'm kind of, I think the sort of the next things I'm interested in are sort of how memory is, how memory is perhaps sort of, the question of memory is perhaps reorientated in a sort of, in kind of, in a sort of post-humanist era, where the sort of the figure of the human is decentered somewhat. And I think what's interesting about a lot of the discussions happening in the humanities around post-humanism, anthropocentrism, and the Anthropocene are interesting questions for area studies or disciplines that can sometimes be seen as area studies. So German studies, for instance, you know, and how you can ask these sort of much more kind of global questions in the context of your particular language area. And I do think those questions are relevant in a particular language and cultural and national context, where national is always sort of reaching out to the kind of transnational. But I think it does kind of challenge sort of German studies, for instance, or other kinds of language disciplines. But it's something that I'm very interested in. Been doing some work recently on Kurt Beckermann's film Heinz Walzer, and I'm very interested in how she remembers the Waldheim affair in the 1980s in a way that's, I think, trying to challenge the sort of the kind of authority of a figure like Waldheim, which is very much a kind of an authority based on a sort of white European male kind of exclusivity. I've been doing some work on that, particularly thinking about Waldheim as former UN Secretary General, and the recording of his voice on the Voyager Golden Record, which is something that Seebald notes, an irony that Seebald notes in The Rings of Saturn, that this man who was known to have been at least present where war crimes were committed should be the voice that speaks on behalf of humanity on this golden record. So and that's something that Beckermann picks up wonderfully in her film Heinz Walzer. So that's something that I've been looking at.
Well, I'm really looking forward to reading that, and it's always great to hear about how working in a particular area or language can also have, of course, global implications and be in conversation mm-hmm. with other fields. Well, thank you so much for joining me this morning, your afternoon. And I hope to talk to you again, and I'm looking forward to reading more of your work. Thank you.
Thanks, Leah. Thanks very much.